homework was a bitch, especially since this year I'd be doing it in the free time I had between school, work, and community service. Not to mention I still had to look for scholarships and fill out college applications and visit my damned therapist twice a week. But I had to do it. Had to get it right this time. No screw-ups with my medicine, however much I hated the stuff. No distractions. I didn't have time to worry about what other people thought of me. Yet I had to. If I seemed too on edge, too paranoid, it wouldn't matter what my grades were. If anyone decided I was crazy or dangerous, I could say goodbye to a future and hello to the happy house. Miles walked back into the gym and settled himself at the scorer's table. For half a second he turned, stared up at me, and quirked that eyebrow before facing the spandex squad again. The base of my skull tingled. I hadn't thought about it before. Why hadn't I thought about it before? Miles! Miles was a genius. Miles liked to screw with people. Miles didn't seem to particularly like me, and I'd been antagonizing him all day. It would be easy for him to figure me out, especially if I kept staring at him like I had in chemistry. Maybe I could head him off, tell him about it before he found out, then beg for his silence or something. "Or you could grow some balls," said the little voice. That was probably the best option. I turned my attention to the scoreboard. McCoy had made at least 5 different announcements about it today, and during each one someone would mimic him and everyone would laugh.
"There's an urban legend about that scoreboard, you know."
Tucker appeared next to me, holding a Coke. I looked around. The bleachers were already full. How did that happen? I glanced over my shoulder, expecting someone to be standing there with a knife. "Really?" I asked absent-mindedly, doing a belated perimeter check. "Somehow I don't find that surprising." Cliff Ackerley and a few other football player types stood at the foot of the bleachers, holding up signs for Rio Wolf, who I gathered was the starting setter. I spotted Celia Hendricks on the edge of a bigger group of students who didn't look like they were putting any effort toward actually watching the game. Parents filed into the gym from the rotunda, holding popcorn and hot dogs and wearing shirts that read, "Go Sabres!"
"What a ridiculous sport,"
said a woman near me, her voice laced with acid.
"Volleyball? They should call it Sluts and Spandex."
I searched for the disgruntled parent, but teenagers surrounded me. I squeezed myself into a smaller space. "Did you hear that woman?" I asked Tucker.
"What woman?"
"The one who said the thing about volleyball players being sluts." Tucker looked around.
"Are you sure that's what you heard?"
I shook my head. "Must have been nothing." I'd learned a long time ago that asking someone else if they heard something was much safer than asking them if they saw it. Most people don't trust their ears as much as they trusted their eyes. Of course, auditory hallucinations were also the most common kind of hallucinations. Not good for me.
"Now cheerleading, that's a sport. A sport with dignity. You make it or you don't. There's no gray area. Not like with volleyball."
Her voice mingled with the crowd and the squeak of shoes on the court, then faded out. Tucker shifted beside me.
"The legend says that some chick who went to East Shoal years ago was so obsessed with high school that she refused to leave it, and in a weird suicide stunt made the scoreboard fall on herself. Now her soul inhabits the scoreboard, influencing matches to help East Shoal win. Or lose. Depends on how she feels that day, I guess."
"Why didn't you tell me that before? Jeez, I thought everyone was obsessed with it for no reason."
"Well, I don't know if everyone's obsessed with it because of the legend, or if the legend grew because everyone's obsessed with it. Anyway, McCoy says we're not supposed to talk about it. But if you really want creepy, you should watch him take care of it. Cleans every light bulb by hand. Caresses it."
I laughed. Tucker paused, his neck and ears turning red. He fidgeted.
"There's also the myth about a python in the ceiling tiles being fed by the lunch ladies. but that one's not too interesting. Do you know about Redwich Bridge?
I shot him a look out of the corner of my eye. I've heard of it.
Never drive through the covered bridge by Hannibal's Rest at night. You hear the witch scream right before she rips you to shreds and leaves your car empty by the side of the road.
A gleam of excitement lit his eyes as he waited for my reaction. Normally, he only got that look when he was telling me about one of his conspiracy theories.
Have you ever done it?
I asked.
Me? Drive through Redwich Bridge? No. I'm as brave as soggy potato salad.
You? Soggy potato salad?
No.
Tucker laughed and puffed out his skinny chest in mock bravado.
I know I don't look it, but I'd rather run the other direction before I got anywhere near that bridge.
He dropped the act and offered me a Coke.
Thirsty?
You don't want it?
Nah. Bought it and then remembered that I hate soda.
I took it hesitantly. You didn't put anything in it, did you?
Do I look like that type of person?
I don't know, Mr. Soggy Potato Salad. You're a wild card. I technically wasn't supposed to have caffeine. My mother said it made me too excitable and screwed with my medicine, which made her a liar because I felt perfectly fine whenever I broke the rules. But I drank it anyway.
I see your textbooks have had a rough day.
Tucker prodded the binding of my calculus book. I said. Stray cat found its way into my locker.
Super glue will fix that right up.
Super glue? Now there was an idea. I glanced down at Miles. He was staring over his shoulder at us, eyes narrowed. The enormity of this balancing act hit me all at once, made my stomach lurch. I couldn't let him walk all over me, but I couldn't make him angry either. Tucker gave him the finger. Miles turned back to the court.
I'll regret that later, Tucker said, when my steering column is gone.
Either Tucker would regret it, or I would.
Are you okay? Tucker asked. You look like you're going to vomit.
Yes. No. I'm okay. This was the least okay thing that had happened to me since the Hill Park Gym graffiti incident. I realized too late that I'd snapped at him. I didn't mean to be harsh, but I hated worry and pity, and that look people got when they knew something wasn't okay with you, and they also knew that you were in denial about it. I wasn't in denial. I just couldn't let it slip this time. Chapter 7. I spent the rest of the game flipping my focus back and forth between my homework and Miles. He didn't look back up at us, but I knew he knew I was watching him. I distracted myself by trying to think of ways to pay Tucker back for the Coke. He ignored me when I brought it up and changed the subject to conspiracy theories. Roswell, the Illuminati, Elvis faking his own death, and when Miles glared up at us again, a nice little story about a Nazi moon base. Tucker was the sort of intelligent, history-savvy person I could throw at my mother and watch him stick, but also the sort of person I'd never do that to because I had a soul. Then I thought, hey, I could hug him. I'm sure he wouldn't mind if I hugged him. But I knew that physical contact meant certain things in the world of normal social conduct, and while I trusted Tucker more than most of the other people I knew, I didn't want to mean those certain things toward him. Tucker left with the crowd when the game ended. I stayed behind to help the club, but they were so quick and efficient that the net was down and the ball cart stowed before I'd stepped off the bleachers. Miles and Jetta stood at the scorer's table. When I walked up to them, they fell silent. I was pretty sure they hadn't been speaking English.
What?
Miles snapped. Do you need me for anything, or can I go home?
Yeah, go.
He turned back to Jetta. Bis später, Alex. Jetta smiled and waved as I walked away. Apparently, any feelings I'd hurt by not shaking her hand had been forgotten. See you. I replied. Outside the school was pandemonium. I expected big crowds after football games, but this looked like the entire school had formed one huge tailgating party. At 8 at night. After a volleyball game. On the first day of school. There was no way I could do a sufficient perimeter check here, so I went for plan B. Get out. I wheeled Irwin out of the bushes where I'd hidden him, and hoped to God no one noticed me. The people closest to the school entrance were the men still standing on the roof, the few football players probably waiting around for their girlfriends, and Celia Hendricks and two other girls doing who the hell knows what. "Nice bike!" Celia called over her shoulder, flipping her bleached hair out of the way. Her two friends stifled laughs. "Where'd you get it?" "Egypt," I said, trying to figure out if she was serious. Celia laughed. "Remind me never to go to Egypt." I ignored her and continued past the football players. I didn't get far. All 230 pounds of Cliff Ackerley fell into step beside me.
"Hey, you're the new girl, right?"
"Yes." His closeness sent shivers crawling up my spine. I veered away to put some distance between us. He planted himself in front of me, pointed at my hair, and yelled,
"Hill Park fan!"
A thunderous, rolling boo instantly rose from the crowd. Most of them probably had no clue I'd actually gone to Hill Park, but brandishing any kind of red around here was asking for trouble. I tried to move around Cliff, but he stuck his foot on Irwin's front tire and pushed. "What the hell?" I stumbled backward to keep Irwin upright.
"What the hell?"
one of the other guys mocked in a high falsetto, a million times more sinister than when Tucker had done it at work the night before. The rest of Cliff's friends circled around me. I squeezed tighter against Irwin. Either these guys were all drunk or they were all douchebags. If they were drunk, they were less likely to see reason, but also less likely to catch me if I ran for it. But I couldn't run with Irwin. Maybe I could use him as a shield. That meant leaving him behind, and the last thing I wanted to do was leave Irwin behind. No matter how I played this situation, outlook not so good. "Why don't you stop being a dick and get out of my way?"
"Ooh, harsh words."
Cliff grinned.
"Here's the deal. I'll let you by if you agree to let us dye your hair green."
"My hair isn't dyed. It's naturally this red." "And no."
"Fine. Then we'll shave it off. Jones has a razor in his car, don't you, Jones?"
I backed away, tugging on a lock of hair. I'd seen documentaries about stuff like this. Bullying, student brutality. They wouldn't really shave my head, would they? But there were so many people, all watching, waiting. The men in suits on the roof weren't doing a thing. So much for school security. The ring of people drew in tighter. There was no... I wouldn't be able to get out. Maybe I could kick Ackerley in the balls and call it a day. Then, everyone went quiet. Cliff's gaze roamed to a spot above my shoulder. Miles stood there, staring Cliff down, the light triplets at his side. Cliff scoffed.
"Need something, Richter?"
"Not at all."
Miles shrugged.
"Please, continue."
Cliff narrowed his eyes and took a step back, looking me over. He leaned to one side and peered around me. "Problem?" I asked. Cliff scoffed again and stepped out of my way, his lips curling in distaste. Miles and the triplets moved to flank me, helping clear a path through the party. There were no more boos, no jeering, no search for razors. But when I looked back, Cliff and his friends had their heads together. And past them, Celia glared daggers at me. "Thanks," I said.
"Didn't do it for you."
Miles stopped beside a rusty sky-blue pickup on the far edge of the parking lot. He yanked the driver's door open and tossed his bag in.
"I really hate that guy."
"Don't listen to anything Cliff says," Theo chimed in, pulling the pencils from her bun and shaking her hair out. "He's a moron.
He thinks we planned to have you do something to make him look stupid. That's why he left you alone. Besides, I don't think he'd know how to use a razor if he had one. I'm pretty sure his mother shaves his facial hair, said Evan.
I'm pretty sure a monkey shaves his facial hair, said Ian. Did you see his face last track season? I thought he'd need a blood donation.
Disregarding his faults and personal hygiene, Miles interrupted. I still think he needs his head shoved into a wood chipper.
I took a long step away from Miles.
Right. Well, I'll see you all tomorrow. The light triplets said goodbye. Maybe they weren't so bad after all. Even if Evan and Ian did look like the exact same person. I hopped on Irwin and rode out of the parking lot, trying to forget about Cliff, Celia, that weird-ass scoreboard, and everything else. I marked Miles' parking spot so I could find his truck again tomorrow morning. I wouldn't let East Shoal and its psychotic inhabitants get the best of me. Chapter 8 My delusions became more frequent in the dark. More than once, when I was little, I heard voices coming from beneath my bed, claws reaching up around the mattress to get me. Riding home, the sunlight fading, an enormous red bird with long tail feathers sailed over me. I stopped to take a picture of it. On the camera screen, its feathers glowed like fire. Freaking phoenixes. I'd had an obsession with phoenixes when I was 10, and this one followed me home every night. The Phoenix of Hannibal's Rest. Hannibal's Rest. Home. Here's the thing about Hannibal's Rest, Indiana. It is astoundingly small. So small, I'm sure it wouldn't show up on a GPS. You'd pass right through without realizing you were anywhere different. It's just like the rest of central Indiana. Hot in the summer, cold in the winter. And the only way to know the weather other times of the year is to walk outside. You drive west to get to Hill Park, and east to get to East Shoal. But nobody from either school can tell you the name of a single person who goes to the other. And they all hate one another. My parents didn't grow up here or anything. They chose to live in this nowhere town. Why? Because it was named after Hannibal of Carthage. Their basic train of thought was this. Hannibal's Rest? And we're naming our child after Alexander the Great? Marvelous! Ah, the history. It tickles. Sometimes I wanted to beat my parents over the head with a frying pan. If you could say one thing about them, it was that they loved history. Literally, both of them were in love with history. Sure, they were in love with each other, but history was like the be-all, end-all of intellectual stimulation to them. They were married to each other and to history. So, naturally, they weren't going to give their kids any old normal names. I was the lucky one. Alexander to Alexandra wasn't a huge leap. Charlie, on the other hand, got the entire blunt force of the namesake sledgehammer. Charlemagne. So from the day she was born, I called her Charlie. I turned down my street and aimed for the one-story, dirt-colored house lit up like a Christmas tree. My mother had this thing about leaving all the lights on until I got home, as if I would forget which house was ours. The sounds of a furious violin poured from the living room window. Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture, as usual. I leaned Irwin up against the garage door and did a perimeter check. Street. Driveway, garage, front yard, porch, house. The porch swing creaked and swayed like someone had just gotten out of it, but that could have been the wind. I did another check when I stepped in through the front door, but the house looked like it always did, cramped and barren at the same time. Charlie stood in the living room with her violin, playing her musical prodigy stuff. When my mother wasn't teaching online college classes, she homeschooled Charlie like she had me, so Charlie was always practicing. My mother was in the kitchen. I braced myself, remembered not to do another perimeter check. My mother hated them, and went to find her. She stood at the sink, dish rag in hand. "I'm home," I said. She turned.
I left a bowl of soup for you. It's mushroom, your favorite.
Minestrone was my favorite soup. Mushroom was Dad's. She always got them mixed up.
Thanks, but I'm not really hungry. I'm gonna go do my homework.
Alexandra, you need to eat.
I hated that voice.
Alexandra, you need to eat. Alexandra, you need to take your pills. Alexandra, you need to put your shirt on right side out.
I sat down at the table, dropping my bag next to me. My books made a pitiful shunk sound, reminding me that I couldn't let my mother look in my bag. She'd think I'd destroyed them, and that would definitely warrant a therapist call.
So, how was it?
All right, I replied, swirling the cold soup in the bowl, checking for poison. I didn't really think my mother would poison me. Most of the time.
That's it?
I shrugged. It was all right. It was a day of school.
Meet anyone interesting?
Everyone's interesting if you stare at them long enough. She put her hands on her hips. Tally one for things Alex shouldn't say at the dinner table.
How did it go with that club?
I really didn't have to do that much. I like them, though. They're nice. Most of them. Mom hmmed in her very passive-aggressive way.
What?
I shot.
Nothing.
I sipped a bit of soup. I'm on speaking terms with the valedictorian and the salutatorian, if that makes you feel any better, I said.
Okay, so the valedictorian was a bit of a stretch.
Most of our conversations that day had ended with one of us pissed off, but I did technically speak to him. Thoughts of blue eyes strutted forward once again, and I beat them back. The moment I mentioned a lobster tank, my mother would have a conniption. She'd spent years trying to forget the freeing of the lobsters.
Oh, really?
My mother perked up a bit.
And what are they like?
The salutatorian's really nice, but the valedictorian could work on his people skills.
You should ask them for college advice, you know,
she said.
I bet they're aiming for the Ivy League. Oh, they could help you with your essays. You've never really been good at writing.
Tally one for mother mentions college future and unlikeliness of such at dinner table. Probably wouldn't help my case to tell her Tucker had applied to half a dozen Ivy League schools and had already been accepted at twice as many less prestigious institutions. I don't need help getting into college. I have good grades, and most people can't write to save their lives, but they get in. Besides, you have to be an idiot not to get into state college.
You're saying that now, she said, waving a soapy knife at me. But what are you going to do when you don't get in?
I dropped my spoon.
The hell, Mom? Do you want me to get in or not?
Language, she snapped, going back to the dishes. I rolled my eyes and hunched over my soup. The violin music came to an abrupt halt. There was a patter of small feet in the hallway, and then Charlie's arms wrapped around me and her momentum nearly knocked me out of my chair. She was undersized for her age, but hit like a wrecking ball. Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
My shirt muffled her voice. I pried Charlie away from my side and stood up, pulling my bag with me. I'm going to my room.
I expect lights out by 10,
my mother said.
Oh, and apparently I need a school uniform.
She slapped a wet hand against her forehead. Water ran down the side of her face.
Oh, I completely forgot. Your principal mentioned a uniform to me when we went on that tour.
How much are they?
Like $70? It's ridiculous. All for a school crest on the breast pocket.
My mother turned to look at me again. Her face creased with that damn pity look. We weren't so poor that we couldn't pay $70 for something I had to have, but she would make me feel awful about it anyway. I'm getting a spare one from the janitor tomorrow, I said quickly. It shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. Good.
She relaxed.
I already laid out your clothes for tomorrow, so you can wear those to school and bring them home with you.
Fine. I stalked out of the kitchen and down the back hallway, Charlie close on my heels. She jabbered incessantly about the song she'd been playing, what she thought of our mother's mushroom soup, how much she wanted to go to high school. She hustled to get inside my bedroom door before I closed it.
Even in the room I'd slept in for 17 years, the place I knew better than anywhere else, I had to make sure nothing was out of the ordinary.
"What's it like?"
Charlie flung herself on my bed and pulled the covers up over her head like a cloak. The resulting gust of air made the pictures tacked to the walls flutter. The artifacts on my shelves rattled ominously.
"Be careful, Charlie! You break anything, you're paying for it."
I opened up the top dresser drawer and pushed pairs of striped socks out of my way until I found my stash of superglue, hidden so my mother wouldn't think I was huffing it. I tossed it onto the nightstand, partly as a warning to Charlie, and partly as a reminder to myself to pick it up for the morning.
"I don't know. It was school."
I grabbed the clothes my mother had left out on the end of the bed and tossed them on the floor. After 17 years, she still picked out my clothes. I was a schizophrenic, not a damn invalid.
"But what was it like?"
This was understandable. Charlie had never set foot in a real school.
"It was like school. I went to class and listened to the teacher and did the work."
"And there were other kids there?"
"Yes, Charlie, there are lots of other kids there. It's a school."
"Did they discriminate against you because you're new?"
"Discriminate." There it was. Charlie's word of the week. Every week, Charlie had a word that she used whenever she could fit it in. This week, it was discriminate. Last week, it was usurp. The week before that, it was defenestrate. Compliments of me. Just thinking about Charlie whipping that one out of her vocabulary utility belt in front of our mother made me smile.
"Has Mom been letting you watch the Disney Channel again?" I opened my closet to look for my pajamas.
"So, they don't sing at lunch?"
"Nope."
"Oh."
The blanket fell away from her head, revealing her straight, ketchup-red hair and big blue eyes. She pulled a black chess piece from her pocket and jammed it into her mouth. She'd been chewing on things since she was 4 years old.
"Did you meet anyone cool?"
"Define cool."
"You know. Cool."
"Not really. I met nice people and stupid people and complete jerks, but I didn't really meet any cool people." Charlie gasped. Her eyes became the size of plates and the chess piece fell out of her mouth.
"Did you meet your soulmate? That always happens on the first day of school, right?"
"Oh, God, Charlie, she's letting you read again. You went straight to the paranormal section, didn't you?" Charlie huffed and crossed her arms.
"No, but the TV doesn't do high school very well."
"The TV doesn't do anything very well, Charlie." She looked glum after that, and I felt sorry that I'd crushed her hopes. She'd never go to high school. The only reason our mother had stopped homeschooling me was because my therapist said I'd do better around people my age. That led to my involvement in the Hill Park gym graffiti incident and my senior year condemnation at East Shoal. A familiar pang of guilt poked at my stomach whenever I looked at Charlie. I was the big sister. I was supposed to set an example and lead the way so people would say, "Hey, you're Alex's sister, aren't you? You two look exactly alike," instead of, "Hey, you're Alex's sister, aren't you? Are you crazy, too?" The only example I was ever going to set for her was to always check her food before she ate it. Relief washed over me. Relief that she wasn't old enough yet to understand why she should hate me. "Get out of my room. I need to change." Charlie whined and pouted, but grabbed the chess piece, scrambled off the bed, and hurried out the door. I changed into my pajamas and slipped under the covers. I looked around the room at all my pictures and artifacts. The pictures had no rhyme or reason. I realized a few years back that sometimes I'd look at an old picture and something would be different in it. Something would be missing. I reached into my bag and pulled out my camera, then flipped through the pictures I'd taken today. The first one from this morning, the one of the squirrels, it was already different. It looked like I'd just taken a picture of the neighbor's lawn. The squirrels were gone. It wasn't always so easy. Some things took longer to disappear than others. but this technique helped me figure out what was a hallucination and what wasn't. I had albums full of pictures, too, but the albums were for things I knew were real, like my parents. Charlie had a whole album to herself. More than once, I caught her in my room looking through it. My artifacts came from my dad. First and foremost, Dad was an archaeologist. I didn't blame him. If I could do nothing but play in the dirt all day, I'd be an archaeologist too. My mother used to travel with him, but then they had me, and they took too long trying to decide if they wanted to take me to the digs. By that time, my mother had ended up homeschooling me and didn't want to take me anywhere. And then Charlie was born, and they didn't have the money to take both of us. So my mother stayed home all the time, and Dad was always gone. Whenever he came home, he brought stuff. Most of the things we owned, our furniture, and even some of our clothes. My mother crammed every available corner with Dad's stuff, and the house didn't feel so empty. I tried not to think about the fact that shipping things like that across the ocean must cost a lot of money. I remembered a few times, before I was diagnosed, when I'd lay in bed and my artifacts would talk to me, or to one another, and I would listen to them until I fell asleep. My artifacts didn't talk to me anymore, at least not when the medicine was working. I turned off my light and rolled over onto my side, pulling my sheet with me. The little boy at the lobster tank was losing his definition, until I reminded myself that even if he was real, which he wasn't, he and Miles were not necessarily the same person. That was 10 years ago. 10 years, and I hadn't seen him since. It would take some ridiculous odds to bring us full circle like that. I didn't fall asleep. I couldn't. I waited until I heard Mom walk down the hall and close her door. Charlie had shut herself in her room half an hour ago, then slipped out from under the covers, put on a jacket and an old pair of sneakers, and grabbed the aluminum baseball bat I kept under my bed. I popped the screen out of the window and set it carefully against the wall. I didn't often ride my bike in the dark, but I walked. Baseball bat clinking against the heels of my Converse, nighttime breeze brushing against my legs, I trekked through my backyard and into the woods of Hannibal's Rest. The creek whispered up ahead. I took the last bend in the road and stood face to face with Redwich Bridge. I didn't feel the need to do a perimeter check, because this was where the worlds met. Everyone thought they saw or heard strange things here, and I didn't have to hide the fact that I really did. I laughed when I remembered Tucker bringing up the bridge earlier. The Red Witch, the one who gutted travelers, coated herself in their blood, and screamed like a banshee? No, I wasn't scared of her. The nighttime might have made everything upside down, inside out, scary as hell. But not to me. The baseball bat clink, clink, clinked as I walked toward Redwich Bridge. I was the scariest thing out here tonight. Chapter 9. Einstein's definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. I kept taking pictures, hoping I'd look at one and know its subject was a hallucination. I did my perimeter checks, thinking I'd eventually be able to walk around paranoia-free. I spent every day hoping someone would tell me I smelled like lemons. If I wasn't insane by anyone else's definition, I figured I was at least insane by Einstein's. Chapter 10. The first thing I did the day after the parking lot incident was look for Miles's truck at school. Rusty sky blue 1982 GMC. Looked like he'd saved it from a scrap heap. It wasn't there. Marvelous. My second order of business was his locker. I hurried into school, checked to make sure no one was around and the ceiling wasn't wired, then delved into my bag in search of superglue. 2 tubes and 17 popsicle sticks later, Miles's locker was well and truly glued shut. I tossed the evidence into the nearest trash can, swapped out what books I needed from my own locker, most still severed from their covers, and left to find a uniform. The janitor's closet was next to my chemistry room. When I knocked, there was a crash inside. The door cracked open, and a familiar, bespectacled eye looked out.
Oh. Hi, Alex.
Tucker opened the door a little wider. His gaze flitted around the hallway behind me.
What are you doing here?
They said I could get a uniform from the janitor.
Oh, yeah. There are some here. Hold on a sec.
He disappeared, and I heard some muted, angry cursing. When he returned, he held a uniform.
It might be a little big, but it's the only clean one. The others were yellow.
I took the uniform. Thanks, Tucker. What are you doing in the janitor's closet? I looked behind him, but I didn't see anyone else. He gave me a weak smile.
Don't worry about it.
And then he closed the door. I forced myself not to take any pictures. It was Tucker. Tucker was not a hallucination, even if he was hanging out in the janitor's closet, and ducked into the nearest bathroom to change. Tucker had really been playing it down when he said the uniform might be a little big. I needed swimming lessons to wear it. I had to pass through the science hallway on my way to class. And that was when I saw the snake. Its head hung down between ceiling tiles that had been shifted to the side for some reason. I jumped. I'd only ever seen pythons in the zoo, behind glass. But annoyance settled in when I got over the initial shock of seeing it. Freaking snake? I didn't even bother getting my camera out. A snake hanging out of the ceiling was exactly the sort of thing my mind would cook up. I stuck out my tongue and hissed at the python as I walked underneath it. I slunk to Mr. Gunthry's room, hoping I wouldn't meet Cliff or Celia or, God forbid, Miles on my way. People still stared at me. This hair, this damn hair, why did it have to be so damn red? But I ignored them. Theo was kneeling outside the classroom door, mixing condiments inside a mason jar while Miles stood next to her with his arms crossed. A shiver ran up my spine when I walked past him, but I forced my face to remain expressionless. He didn't notice me. If he did, he didn't say anything. I got a glimpse of Theo's disgusting concoction. Pickle juice, mustard, what looked like pepper shavings, sour cream, horseradish. Basically all the things you put together when you're 13 and you want to trick a younger sibling into a vomit-induced coma. Charlie had never forgiven me for that one. I slipped into my seat, keeping them in my peripheral vision while I did a perimeter check. Theo capped the mason jar, shook it, and handed it to Miles. Miles watched the cloudy, swirling liquid for a second, then raised it to his lips and chugged the whole thing in one fell swoop. I gagged and yanked my collar up over my nose. Ironically, the collar smelled like barf already, so I lowered it. Miles sauntered into the room and dropped into the chair in front of me, his gaze fixed on the whiteboard. Class started normally. As normally as it could, I suppose, when the first announcement of the day is about a scoreboard and your drill sergeant of a teacher is yelling at everyone. I tried paying attention to Mr. Gunthry's lecture on British literature, but the side of Miles's face had turned chalky white and was morphing into sickly green.
The fact that Burgess taught alongside the woman who would give him ideas for A Clockwork Orange is very little known. He was in the army at the time.
Mr. Gunthry stopped in front of Cliff's desk, leaned over, and got right into Cliff's face. Cliff, who had been making hand signs across the room at Rhea Wolf, jumped and faced forward.
Tell me, Mr. Ackerley, do you know where Burgess was stationed?
Cliff's mouth popped open like he was going to say something.
No? That's a pity, Mr. Ackerley. Perhaps I should ask someone else. Do you think I should ask someone else, Mr. Ackerley? Yes? Who do you think I should ask, Ackerley? Richter? Richter. That sounds like a question, Ackerley. Did I give you permission to ask me a question?
No.
No what?
No, sir.
Now I'm going to ask you again, Mr. Ackerley. To whom should I ask the question your incompetent ass couldn't answer? Ask Richter, sir.
Mr. Guntree straightened up and marched across the room to Miles's desk.
Richter, could you please tell me where Anthony Burgess was stationed when he taught alongside Anne McGlynn and took her ideas on communism for A Clockwork Orange?
Miles didn't answer at first. He was hunched in his seat, swaying a little. Slowly he looked up and met Mr. Guntree's gaze.
Please throw up on him, I thought. Please, please throw up on Mr. Guntree.
Gibraltar,
Miles said. Then he lurched out of his seat and made it to the trash can in time to be violently ill. Several girls squealed. Tucker yanked his collar up over his nose.
You all right, Richter?
Mr. Guntree dropped his book and walked over to clap Miles on the back. Miles spit one more time and put a hand on Mr. Guntree's shoulder.
Yeah, I'm fine. Must have eaten something bad at breakfast.
Miles wiped his mouth on his sleeve.
If I could go to the restroom? Clean up? Of course.
Mr. Guntree gave Miles another sharp slap on the back.
Take as much time as you need. I'm sure you've got this all memorized anyway, haven't you?
Miles gave him a wry smile and left. Chapter 11. Tucker found me after lunch and reassured me that Miles had been running a job.
A job? What, like the mafia?
Sort of. Tucker leaned back against the wall outside the cafeteria.
People pay him to do things. Usually revenge stuff. You know, steal someone's homework and paste it on the ceiling. Put dead fish in someone's glove compartment. Stuff like that.
So what was he doing this morning? I asked. Tucker shrugged.
You usually don't know until it happens. One time he hid 100 water balloons full of grape juice in Leslie Stapleford's locker. When she opened it, there were toothpicks or something that popped all the balloons and set off a chain reaction. Ruined everything she had.
Note to self. Stand to side of locker door when opening.
Did you hear the announcement today?
Tucker asked, changing the subject.
Oh, about McCoy hiring someone to fit the scoreboard with gold plating?
Yeah. I told you he was crazy, right? I hear he does some weird stuff at home, too.
He said it with a conspiratorial stage whisper.
Like mowing his lawn and trimming his peonies.
Peonies? I balked. God, he really is a freak. Tucker laughed. The cafeteria doors beside him swung open and Celia Hendricks walked out, with Brittany Carver and Stacy Burns. I stepped back, slightly behind Tucker.
"What's funny, Beaumont?"
she asked with a sneer, as if he'd been laughing at her.
"None of your business, Celia."
All humor left Tucker's face.
"Don't you have a Makeup Addicts Anonymous meeting to get to?"
"Don't you have a cult in a closet to get to?"
she shot back.
"Oh, wait. I forgot. You have no friends. My bad."
The tips of Tucker's ears turned pink and he glared at her, but didn't say anything else.
"God, Beaumont, you're so weird. Maybe if you acted like a normal person once in a while..."
"I'm his friend," I cut in. "And I think he's perfectly normal." Celia looked me up and down, her eyes lingering on my hair. And then she huffed and stomped away without another word.
"You didn't have to say that," Tucker mumbled.
"Yeah, I did," I replied. "There is no force in high school more powerful than one person's blunt disagreement." The rest of the day passed without a hitch. Miles did not acknowledge my presence. I did not acknowledge his. Miles's locker was still glued shut when I left for gym. The entire west side of the school was for extracurriculars. The gym, pool, and auditorium were all connected by hallways that ran behind them, and a large rotunda at their center, linked to the rest of the school by a main hall. Lining the rotunda were huge cases filled with trophies the school had won over the years. Athletics, music competitions, color guard. There were pictures in black and white of the winning teams alongside some of them. The picture that caught my attention didn't have a trophy, and wasn't from a competition. It was a framed newspaper clipping. Someone had taken a bright red marker to the girl in the picture, partially obscuring her face. But I could tell she was pretty, blonde, and wearing an old East Shoal cheerleader's uniform. She stood next to the scoreboard, which looked brand new. Beneath the picture was the caption, "Scarlett Fletcher, captain of the East Shoal cheerleading squad, helps introduce Scarlett's scoreboard, a commemoration of the charity and goodwill her father, Randall Fletcher, has shown toward the school." The picture was framed in gold and set up on a tiny dais like it was sacred. I spotted Miles on the other side of the rotunda. He was standing outside the concession stand talking to a kid I'd never seen before. As I watched, they made a quick exchange. Miles gave the kid something thin and gold and got a handful of cash in return. "What was that?" I asked, stomping up to Miles as soon as the kid had walked away. It looked very much like Mr. Guntry's fountain pen. "I'm not ruling out the possibility that you're an accomplished pickpocket." Miles raised his eyebrow as if I was a very amusing puppy. "So that's the only reason you drank that awful stuff this morning? So you could steal a teacher's pen? For money?" Miles shoved his hands into his pockets. "Are you done now?" "Let me see." I tapped my chin. "Yep, all done, asshat." I started to walk away.
"Alex, wait."
I turned back. It was the first time he'd said my name. He held a hand out.
"Well played," he said.
"Oh, no. No, we were not doing this. I hadn't spent 10 minutes gluing his locker shut just to admit it to him." So I arched my own eyebrow and said, "I don't know what you're talking about." The corners of his lips twisted up right before I walked away. "It can't be him. It's not him, is it?" "Cannot predict now." "I know, I've asked you 12 times already, but just yes or no." "Concentrate and ask again. You only have 2x as many positive answers as negative and noncommittal. How does this keep happening?" "It's not him, is it?" "Better not tell you now." "You said that one before." "I'm going to ask 1 more time. He's a jerk. So he can't be Blue Eyes, right? Reply hazy. Try again." Reply hazy my ass. Chapter 12. The transition from Hill Park to East Shoal was significantly easier than I'd expected. It was the same basic high school garbage wrapped in a slightly different skin. The only difference was that everything at East Shoal was completely insane. There were several things I learned that first month. 1. The scoreboard really was a school legend, and Mr. McCoy really was dearly, dearly in love with it. Mr. McCoy had his own brand of crazy. He continually reminded everyone of scoreboard day, when we were all supposed to bring in an offering of flowers or light bulbs for the scoreboard, as if it was a wrathful Mayan deity that would kill us if we disobeyed. Somehow he managed to cover this insanity with a mask of good test scores and even better student conduct. It seemed like, as far as the parents and teachers were concerned, he was a perfect principal. 2. There was a cult entirely dedicated to discussing pre-existing conspiracy theories and determining if they were true. They met in a janitor's closet. 3. The cult was run by Tucker Beaumont. 4. Mr. Guntry, the most in-your-face teacher in the school, because of the yelling, see, was nicknamed the General, because of his penchant for going on war-related rants and wielding his treasured golden fountain pen as a weapon. He'd done 2 tours in Vietnam. and he had a long family history of war-related deaths, which rendered me almost incapable of not calling him Lieutenant Dan. 5. 20 years ago, as the senior prank, someone had let the biology teacher's pet python loose. It had escaped behind the ceiling tiles, never to be seen again. 6. Everyone. And when I say everyone, I mean absolutely positively everyone, from the librarians, to the students, to the staff, to the oldest, crustiest janitor, was pissed down their legs scared of Miles Richter. Of all the crazy things I heard about East Shoal, that was the only one I couldn't believe. Chapter 13. I must have set a record. With the backpack pushing and the assignment ripping and all the general childishness that occurred between me and Miles, it only took him a month to banish me to work in the concession stand with Theo. I was fine with this because, A, I liked Theo better than him, B, I was less paranoid when he wasn't around, and C, I didn't have to sit in a gym full of people I didn't know. It didn't take me long to get used to Theo. She was so good at getting things done that I figured if she wanted to hurt me, she would have done it by now. I thought I had a lot of homework, but Theo's back should have broken from the size of her bag. 7 AP classes, plus I'm retaking the SATs and ACTs because I know I got cheated last time, she said. I keep all the other stuff I need over here in this pocket, and then my first aid kit is in this pocket. Why do you have a first aid kit? I asked. When you have two brothers like mine, someone's always getting hurt. She shoved her physics book onto the counter and opened it up. I don't know how you do that, I said. Do you go home after club and do homework all night? She shrugged. Not most of the time. I work graveyard shifts at the showtime. You wouldn't believe how late people come in to watch movies. She paused, then said with a sigh, My parents make me. Why? She shrugged again. That's just the way it is. They've always been like that. They wanted me to take all these AP classes, too. They made you join the club, too? Theo grinned. No, none of us voluntarily joined the club, except Jetta. Evan and Ian and I got put here when we snuck laxatives into the chili at lunch 2 years ago. She laughed. So worth it. I snorted. Theo was okay. How'd everyone else get here? They found Art with some weed in the bathroom, but he's the best wrestler we've got, so instead of suspending him from the team, they sent him here. I didn't peg Art as a pot smoker. That's because he's not, said Theo. He was trying to stop some of his teammates from smoking, and they let him take the fall. Does anyone actually get thrown out of this school, or are they all given to Miles for safekeeping? I've only ever heard of people getting expelled for violent stuff, like fighting or bringing a weapon to school. What about Jetta? Theo stared at her physics textbook and sighed. I think Jetta's here because of Boss. What do you mean? Jetta came here last year and she didn't speak English very well. Boss was the only one who bothered to talk to her. What about Miles? I asked quickly, before Theo could turn to her homework. What did he do to get here? Hmm? Theo looked up. Oh, Boss? I'm not sure. Me and Evan and Ian were the first people to join the club, but Boss has always been here. He used to do all this stuff by himself. She suddenly stopped talking. Miles was at the big concession stand window. He dropped a worn black notebook on the counter and leaned in. How's the game? Theo asked. Imagine 1,000 starving orphans on a sinking ship in the middle of a shark-infested sea. And you're getting close to how much I don't want to be there, Miles said dryly. I get to hear Clifford talk about how nice Rhea's ass is every 15 seconds. They've been dating since 7th grade. You'd think he'd be over it by now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bored, said Miles.
What's new?
Asked Theo. Let's play 5 questions. Theo snapped her book shut.
Why, may I ask? It's not going to make you any less bored, and we might as well start calling it 3 questions because it doesn't take you 5 anymore.
What's 5 questions? I asked.
It's like 20 questions, only not 20 because boss can do it in 5, said Theo. I've got someone. Go.
Are you a president? Asked Miles.
Yes.
Do your first and last names start with the same letter?
Yes.
You're Ronald Reagan.
See?
Theo threw her hands in the air.
Two questions. I didn't mind not having many responsibilities with the club as long as Miles kept reporting that I was doing what I was supposed to. It gave me more time to write out long-winded college essays about how my illness shaped me. My nightly mountains of homework made the Tower of Babel look like a toothpick, and it was only worsened by my late shifts at Finnegan's. Finnegan's wasn't too bad on its own, but as soon as Miles waltzed in, I had the sudden urge to both hide and put soap in his food. Every time I walked past Miles, I got the distinct feeling that he'd stick his leg out and trip me. He didn't, of course, because that wouldn't be subtle at all, and not Miles Richter's style. Nail files, hedge trimmers, and homemade flamethrowers were more his speed. I gave him his burger and retreated behind the counter, where I asked the magic eight ball, "Will Miles Richter try to kill me?" "Most likely," it replied. By late September, we had regular labs every week. I glanced at him a few times as he made tables in his lab notebook. He was bent over, his glasses slipping down his nose, his left hand curled around so he could write properly. His sleeves were rolled up, and I noticed for the first time that his forearms were freckled, too. Were they warm? They seemed like they'd be warm. Blue Eyes's hand had been warm. There were 4 inches between my hand and his arm. 4 inches, and I'd know for sure. Don't do it, idiot. Don't you dare do it. I stifled the urge and asked a question instead. So, can you really speak another language? I hadn't heard that weird accent from him since the first day, but I knew he and Jetta had been speaking German.
Where'd you hear that?
Miles didn't look up.
Is it true?
Maybe. Depends on who told you.
I figured it out myself, I said. It wasn't hard.
Is it German?
Miles slapped his pen on his lab notebook.
Why are you here exactly?
Because they put me in this class. Don't look at me like it's my fault.
Why are you here? In this school? In the club?
His voice was too low for our neighbors across the table to hear.
What did you do?
What did you do? I shot back. Because it must have been pretty weird if they made you run the whole club by yourself without a teacher supervising.
Nothing, he said.
Seriously, though.
Seriously, nothing. Now why don't you answer my question, since you seem so intent on getting information out of me but refuse to give any up yourself?
I looked at the calcium carbonate. I spray-painted the gym floor.
Spray-painted what?
The gym floor, I just said.
What did you spray-paint on the gym floor?
The W in what came out hard like a V.
Words.
I smiled brightly at the pissy expression on his face. Screwing with him was so unexplainably worth it. I turned back to the Bunsen burner and listened to him seethe. Game nights in the concession stand hit occasional lulls, so Theo and I entertained ourselves making plastic cup pyramids and talking about English class. I found out that Theo wrote for the school newspaper, which was why I always saw her talking to Claude Gunthrie, the editor.
I know, he looks kind of constipated all the time.
She knocked over a stack of cups in her excitement.
But you haven't seen his biceps. My God, they're beautiful.
I feel like I should constantly be watching my back in that class, you know? I said. I've had a weird feeling about Rhea since school started. Rhea sat near me in class, but all I'd ever seen her do was bat her eyelashes at Cliff and giggle like some kind of perky latte-fueled automaton.
Bria's really not all that bad, said Theo.
You'd think she would be. She's popular, but she doesn't go picking for food among us lower beings. Unless she's looking for a distraction from Cliff.
Why would she need a distraction from Cliff?
They've been dating since 7th grade,